Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research and unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And on our show today, Adam, we get to talk with Dr. Susan Glaude from Penn State Hershey Medical Center about the cost of quality. And in this age of us really pushing and promoting quality of our medical care, it really does raise some interesting questions about patient-centeredness. I'm looking forward to it.
And it may not just be the economic cost, the cost of financial cost. I think our guest today suggests maybe there's some other costs like human cost and ethical costs. I'm really looking forward to this conversation.
Me too. But first, we have some research that matters. We're going to talk a little bit about physician-assisted dying and about...
Physician-assisted dying or helping patients with assisted dying that physicians have to do?
We're going to talk about it.
I hope it's not physician-assisted dying.
Yeah. All right. We're also talking about fast food consumers and if you make different choices based on the labels.
This is some interesting research by one of our own doctors at UNC.
Mm-hmm. Talk about triggers for migraines and if they're a myth or not.
And finally, about vegetarian living and heart disease. So let's dive right in, Christy, with this very first article. It was actually a commentary in the New England Journal of Medicine by one of the former editors of the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Marcia Engel, about this Death with Dignity Act that was proposed in front of Massachusetts voters, and it was defeated 51-49 in the recent election.
And it raises some questions about the physician's role in caring for patients who are dying, who in many cases cannot be healed or have terminal illness, and what a physician is allowed to do to help them or support them if they'd like to hasten their death from really profound suffering.
Yeah, I found this a really interesting topic, Christy, because there's controversy here. It's not like that it's uniform that the public believes that assisted dying should be something that's available uniformly to people who have maybe intractable pain and maybe a terminal illness. And the question is, even as physicians, is this something that is commonly agreed to, or is this also controversial?
Well, I think it raises a lot of questions that we don't have time to talk about now. But to me, the controversy has a lot to do with trust and mistrust of the medical system and of physicians. And I do think that there are times between a physician and a patient in some rare settings where, and in many settings, where the focus really needs to be about what's in the best interest to relieve suffering for that patient. Where that line should be is really where the ethical decision is. But the controversy, I think, tends to get hyped up around mistrust of people trying to kill other people. Gets twisted.
Well, in this particular case, also, if it's your patient that's requesting a role in assisted dying, and if you as a physician either are not comfortable with that, or you want someone else to actually prescribe the medicine or not, this is part of that other kind of the in the mix there, so to speak. And the Massachusetts Medical Society came out in opposition to this initiative. But then Dr. Engel and her colleagues have some other proposals that perhaps they believe can advance this forward to a place where the population may have that trust. But we need to really do a whole show on this, Christy. This is an important topic. I've got aging parents. I'm going to be aging. My patients are aging.
And we want to promote a conversation between patients and their providers that really does support and promote dying gracefully. That's something that we should be allowed to do, and there should be open dialogue about what exactly that means and how to do that.
So let's commit today. We're going to do an upcoming show on what is or is not the physician's role in this process, but we all agree about supporting those who are suffering. Let's talk about our very next research that matters, Christy. This was some research that was actually done by one of our colleagues, Dr. Anthony Vieira at UNC Family Medicine, about fast food and what do consumers want when they look at menu items?
I really love the study. It was published in the journal Appetite.
I didn't even know there was a journal called Appetite.
I didn't either, but
I'm going to subscribe to that one as long as I don't gain calories reading the articles.
Exactly. So what they did was they randomly assigned one or four types of menus to about 800 adults in the study, and that they either got menus with no nutritional information.
Kind of like the regular menu you get today.
Yeah, some with calorie information. Some with calorie information plus minutes to walk to burn those calories. And finally, how many calories were in it plus how many miles it would take to walk to burn those calories off.
Yeah, I found this really interesting, Christy, because, you know, I have so many patients who don't really know that to burn off, you know, 1,000 calories, how much you actually have to walk. And you can say, well, it's 45 minutes, or you can say it's 3 miles. And does that make a difference? And Dr. Vieira's research shows that at least in this experimental setting, mm-hmm. it did.
I mean, to go through those four categories, people averaged about 1,000 calories if they ordered with no nutritional information, about 927 calories if they had calorie information. That decreased to 916 for people who had the calories plus the minutes to walk to burn it, and then all the way down to 826 if it had the calories plus the number of miles to walk to burn off those calories. So having that information really did guide at least the people in the study for what they were going to choose.
And before we kind of jump on the bandwagon, literally exercise here, we should have some caution. This was done in a controlled setting, not in real-time setting. And those who tended to be overweight or obese were less likely actually mm-hmm. to use this information. So I think there's more to be said. But I think putting this in terms that people can really understand the consequences of these decisions, good idea. I like it.
Mm-hmm. It's in plain, very accessible language. Okay, now the next is about migraines and triggers. And if you are listening out there and you have migraines, you know that there may be certain things. Your doctor encourages you to find what things bring them on.
Are you talking to me, Christy? Did you know I've had a migraine before?
I did know that. I have as well, but I wasn't talking to you. I was thinking if we've both had them.
But this is kind of interesting because, this is one of those things that a lot of listeners out there, maybe like Christy and I, we relate to this because we have had migraines. I don't have them daily, but I know many of my patients do. And the question is, does being exposed to things like stress or bright lights or being really upset or exercise, sometimes that people think is triggers, does that mean then you can't go into bright lights or can't exercise because it might trigger a migraine?
So they took 27 people, so a small study, who have problems with migraines with aura, with those extra symptoms, who reported triggers, just as you mentioned, Adam, and then put them in to situations where they had to exercise, where they were exposed to bright flashing light, where they and then they were monitored afterwards to see if they reported any migraines.
And it turned out that really just as many who had the exposure to this had a migraine as those who did not. And it was a small percentage of overall, regardless. And so it really causes us to rethink this whole idea of this aura, A-U-R-A, and whether that uniformly means you should not do something. So it may be that clearly once you get a migraine, certainly a bright light may affect you, but it doesn't mean a bright light necessarily causes your migraine. I found this interesting, and I love research on migraines because I think it's something that's so common and we don't even have enough real understanding of them.
Well, and this could free some listeners who have migraines, if you have these certain things that you list as triggers, to just try it and see. I mean, exercise is something that's very good for you. So going ahead and doing it in this case, at least in this study, didn't trigger the migraine. So maybe we shouldn't be as afraid.
Nope. Speaking of afraid, a good way of lowering your risk of heart disease for people who are fearful, maybe a family history of heart disease, is our last research that matters, Christy, article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, trying to tease out, does a vegetarian diet really lower the risk of heart disease? Is it really due to the vegetarian diet that does it?
So we do have some older evidence suggesting that non-meat eaters have fewer heart problems. This was another study looking at 45,000 people.
45,000.
That's a lot.
That's a lot.
And they followed them over 11 or 12 years.
Which is a long time.
A long time. So they got their diet, lifestyle, general health in the 1990s. About a third of them had a vegetarian diet without meat or fish, and followed them over time to see which of those patients developed heart disease.
And those who were vegetarians were one-third less likely to develop heart disease than those who ate meat. And they controlled for the age and the exercise and general health measures. And when they controlled for obesity, it still was close to a third, about 28%, which indicates this is not a randomized trial, but it's a really good study that really suggests that there is something. Not just that healthier people are being vegetarian, so they're less likely to have it, but something about that diet and lifestyle. That's not too surprising to me, but I like to see this because it really has implications for lots of people.
They thought it was likely due to the cholesterol and blood pressure effect of that vegetarian diet, and certainly encourage people, even if you can't go to an extreme one, to cut down on those fatty meat items in your diet, at least reduce the amount, could have some health benefits.
Less meat lowers your cholesterol, probably lowers blood pressure, may cut heart disease. Well, Christy, that concludes our Research That Matters. We've had a good chance to talk about lowering risk of heart disease with a more vegetable-based diet.
We talked about migraine triggers possibly being a myth.
About when I go out and order that 1,000 calories, maybe I'll order an 800-calorie meal when I can see how many minutes I have to work it off.
And a little bit about redefining a physician's role in assisted dying.
Well, Christy, we're going to take a short break. When we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Susan Glad from Penn State Hershey Medical Center about the cost of quality. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of 97.9 FM, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on WCHL.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're going to be talking with Dr. Susan Glad from Penn State Hershey Medical Center about the cost of quality. Welcome to Your Health, Dr. Glad.
Thank you very much, Adam and Christy.
You are a hospitalist and a palliative medicine physician, and yet your first story comes not directly from your care as a physician, but your experience as a patient. And I wonder if you might frame the article that you wrote in reflection of your experience from being a patient.
Sure. This is an experience that my husband and I had surrounding the birth of our first child, our daughter, which was about 2 years ago. She unfortunately had to be delivered early because she was suffering from a blockage in her small intestines. And when we were admitted to the hospital for her delivery, it was a very humbling experience in vulnerability and being out of control and not really knowing what was going on and not having any easy solutions to fix it.
Kind of like many of our patients when they come in the hospital.
Yeah, it was a very different experience for me. And even though I thought I had an idea of what it must feel like to be in the hospital and be in that situation, it was very different for me to actually find myself as the patient and being a part of the hospital system.
And yet you work on quality issues. Christy and I work on quality issues. The whole healthcare system now and Obama and the legislation is to improve quality. So what was the problem with your delivery and what happened?
You know, I think that although we received outstanding medical care, both my daughter and I, the one incident that really stuck with me when I was in the hospital centered around the morning after her delivery when the doctor in charge of my care came in to visit me and it had had been a long night full of surgeries and trips to the ICU with her. And one of the first questions I was asked was what I was planning to use for contraception when we went home in order to prevent an unintended pregnancy.
And what?
Yeah.
That's what I would say. What?
And I think, you know, had I been in a little better place emotionally, that's probably what I would have said, too. And I think that the lesson from that was that this was with the best of intentions, and that unintended pregnancy is a big issue for women who have just given birth. And it's an important quality measure that we all look at. But for my situation, that was just so incongruous with everything else that was going on. I was completely taken aback. I had no answer prepared for that question. It just sort of completely blew me out of the water. And even after I left the hospital, even though I had had so many difficult conversations with so many providers, out of all the flashbulb moments that arose from that experience, that was the one I kept coming back to. I kept remembering that particular experience.
And was that, do you think, a student or a young doctor trying to sort of get through their checky boxes of things they're required to ask without enough training or couth or something from their mother that taught them to sort of step back and really think about what they're asking and the timing of that? Or what do you think that was really about?
You know, I don't think it was. I would like to think that that's what it was. And I don't think that there was anything malicious about that. But the fact is that attending physicians walked into the room and asked me that same question. And I think it was about filling out checky boxes. But the problem is that we are judged based on that. We are judged based on whether we address all of these quality measures during a patient's hospital stay. And I struggle with that now that I'm back in patient care when people are going home on hospice and I'm still asked to counsel them on quitting smoking or changing their diet or lowering their cholesterol. These are measures by which we are judged, even though they may not be appropriate for individual patients.
And so I think we maybe should explain that a little bit for our listeners. When we say we're judged by these things, what that means, that people are reviewing our charts to see that we've documented
who?
These answers and who.
Who's they?
Well, I think that the hospital system of reimbursement of how the hospital gets paid essentially is complicated, but part of that is demonstrating to insurers and Medicare that you have done due diligence in terms of maintaining a person's quality of life and health to the best extent that you can. And part of that is counseling individual patients on things that may adversely affect their health, like smoking, like diet, like exercise. And so there are people who come and look at the chart and see whether or not you've documented whether you counseled the patient on certain things. And sometimes reimbursement factors into that.
We're talking with Dr. Susan Glad about her article in the Annals of Internal Medicine about the cost of quality. And Dr. Glad, you have an example in your article about smoking and smoking cessation in an area that you do work in, hospice care. Tell us about that story.
This was a gentleman who was a longtime smoker, who had very advanced lung cancer, and who had chosen to forego further treatment. He didn't want to get any more chemotherapy or radiation. He wanted to go home, and he wanted to spend time with his family, and he wanted to continue to smoke because it was an important part of his life, and he found comfort in it. I supported him in that. I helped him to enroll in hospice, and I didn't realize until he had his discharge paperwork in his hand that there was literature within the paperwork about stopping smoking. And the fact is that everyone in our hospital, and I would guess probably in most hospitals, are given literature like this when they're discharged from the hospital. And when I saw him read that, he sort of joked about it, and he didn't make a big deal about it. But I saw that it hurt him to receive that kind of information at that point in his life when he was dying from lung cancer. And he just didn't need that as part of his discharge paperwork. But
because it was not, in this particular case, the message that 99 out of 100 patients might and should receive when they get that diagnosis or when they're leaving the hospital and they smoke, but the one out of 100 or whatever that needed to hear a different message, and that message wasn't the one given.
Right, because he's an individual, and the status quo did not apply to him. The algorithm that we use for other patients really didn't apply.
Well, and also it was not congruent with the conversation and agreement that he and his medical provider, being you, it's not congruent with what you had discussed and what he had chosen. So then to get advice from the doctor that said something different must have felt impersonal.
I could see that he was hurt by it, and it's difficult to know what to do in that situation, because I think Adam's right. 99 times out of 100, that could be helpful, and that kind of advice from a provider, whether it's written or given verbally, might be just the piece of advice that helps a person stop smoking. But for him, things were different.
Well, we're going to need to take a short break, but when we return, we're going to continue talking with our guest, Dr. Susan Glad, about the cost of quality and the cost sometimes of to humans, of patients, and even providers. We'll be right back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health on 97.9 FM WCHL.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Dr. Susan Glad from Hershey Medical Center about her article in the Annals of Internal Medicine, The Cost of Quality. And Dr. Glad, right before we broke, you had given us a story about the patient who quality measures as defined may not be applied to. And it made me think of one of my patients, or many of my patients here at the University of North Carolina, who we want to make sure that their hemoglobin A1C for diabetes goes real low and their blood pressure also goes real low. And we want to make sure they have the medicines and they come back frequently, but yet they don't have any money and they don't have resources. And this conflict between what I'm getting measured comes right into play against what they really can do or want to do. What do I do with that?
Yeah, I think that's a great point, and I think you're not alone. I think we all struggle with that. We're judged based on a number, an A1C, or whether or not a patient can take their medicines, when the patient may not even have the money to buy food or have the transportation to get to our office visit. And so although we feel a sense of triumph when we get those numbers just a little bit better, or we are able to arrange for a ride for a patient to come to see us in the office for some counseling, that's not always judged as acceptable. And I think it's a difficult situation without a great or easy answer.
Well, this is a tricky conversation, because the effort to improve quality through systems of care and streamlining processes so that everyone is treated the same, if you will, does have improvements in health. Like, outcomes on a population level do get better when we make sure we have checks and balances and efforts for quality improvement. But then here we are struck with this pull from patient-centeredness. Where do we go from here? What do you think the sort of the central crux of two good things and blending them together should be?
You know, I think one of the challenges we face is that there are some measures of quality that are just really difficult to quantify and to measure. I think, for example, there are some quality measures that are very clear-cut. How can we prevent infections when we do a knee replacement? How can we prevent infections when we put in a central catheter, an IV in one of the deep veins for a patient in the ICU who needs it? It's easy to measure the outcome of that. It's easy to develop an algorithm to maintain patient safety. But some things are more difficult. How can we know whether or not printing information about quitting smoking on our discharge paperwork really helps people to quit smoking? How can we know whether or not we're good communicators when we talk about end of life in the ICU? Does patient satisfaction scores really reflect whether or not we're good communicators? And so I think we've run a little bit into the problem of we're trying to apply the same algorithmic rules to situations that are more individual and are more difficult to measure.
Well, speaking of individuals and end of life, you have a very touching and I think poignant story in your essay about someone admitted to the hospital who may or may not have been at end of life, but that's how the system thought of her and what that did to how she thought and then your relationship. Can you tell us about that story?
Sure. This was a lady who was also suffering from cancer, but had been admitted to the hospital with a pneumonia. And we had every expectation that she would get better and be able to go back home, even though she was near the end of her life. She and I agreed that she had some quality of life remaining. However, she didn't want to go to the ICU, or if her heart stopped, she didn't want us to try to restart it. And so what that means in the hospital is that the physician places an order in the system that if she should lose consciousness or her heart should stop beating or she shouldn't be able to breathe on her own, that we wouldn't try to resuscitate her and put her through that discomfort. What that means on a realistic standpoint is that she got a plastic bracelet that said DNR, DNI, don't resuscitate and do not intubate. This helps people who may not know her. If they're in the situation where she suddenly becomes medically unstable, this helps other healthcare providers know that she doesn't want these measures. But the thing that struck her is that every time she ate a meal or looked down at her hand or went to wash up, she saw that bracelet. And it was very difficult for her to essentially be faced with her mortality every time she looked at her hand because of this plastic bracelet around her wrist. She found that very difficult, and she became very angry with me during her hospital stay after she had that bracelet in place. And I didn't have an easy answer for her about what we could do to make that easier for her.
Well, and I had a same conversation just yesterday in clinic where someone didn't want that gold form beside their bed that says do not resuscitate, because that just felt like every night when she went to bed, she would know it's there, or she opened her drawer, she would know this thing is there. And so a conversation about how to protect her and her wishes and respect her while also not sort of making someone feel bad or insecure or more vulnerable by way of seeing it all over the place. And so thinking about this conversation, we're talking about systems to ensure quality and good patient care combined with a real patient-centeredness. And I wonder what your thoughts are, and I'm sure you've gotten a lot of response from your article, but what are your thoughts about the next steps and the next phase of doing this well?
I think that's a difficult question. I think there's been a lot of talk lately about what's called value-added care, which is more of an engineering term, but really looking at what interventions, what things that we do actually help patients, and what things that we do are just essentially busy work and more paperwork for the rest of us. I'm not sure that there's one solution to these problems that are more individual and more on a public health basis, like quitting smoking, like do not resuscitate orders, things like that. I think that what's really needed are in-depth conversations with patients from their providers so that patients really understand all of the different aspects of the quality measure agreement that they're entering into with their physician. But that, as you know, takes a lot of time, and that's not a commodity that we have a lot of now as physicians, that as we get more and more busy and have less and less time to spend with our patients. So I think other than having these kinds of discussions early on so that we have more time to answer questions and understand things from the point of view of the patient is one answer, but I don't see a way that we're going to get more time to talk to patients anytime in the near future.
Well, I do think that your article is a step in the right direction. And maybe as mm-hmm. we teach our next generation of learners and our colleagues about quality, they can read your article about the cost of quality and have a balanced perspective. And maybe that'll be one step in the direction.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Dr. Susan Glad about her article in the Annals of Internal Medicine about the cost of quality. And right before we leave, Dr. Glad, we should let our listeners know you've just had another baby, and we want to say congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations.
And we hope that it went better this time.
Much better.
You didn't get asked about choice of contraception as the very first question there. And the last question, I just have to know, you work at Penn State Hershey Medical Center, right?
That's right.
I assume this is in Hershey, Pennsylvania?
That's correct.
And the question is the terms of employment, do you get free chocolate?
We don't need it. All the roads are paved in chocolate here.
Well, sounds like
Christy and I are ready to come up for a visit.
Yeah, come on up.
Okay, sounds delicious.
Well, we want to thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today, and we look forward to more stories from you that hopefully will help us all in this search for both quality but also humaneness.
Thank you so much.
We're going to take a short break, but coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
The Family Medicine. Your health continues now.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I get to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and your concerns.
And Christy, we have some great questions today from our listeners about infections in the testicular area, about people who are dizzy, shingles, all kinds of things. And so anyone out there, our listeners who'd like to send us questions, please do send them your comments at yourhealth@unc.edu.
Let's take our very first House Call question today about a fancy word called epididymitis.
My doctor said I might have epididymitis. It sounds really scary, and I can't even pronounce the word.
Well, I can imagine why it is scary. Words that are hard to pronounce for even doctors sometimes are scary. And I imagine for medical students, this is one of those words that they have a hard time saying, and even spelling is even worse. Epididymitis.
It is a hard word, and also it's scary, I think, for some people because it does affect that area of the testicles. What it is swelling or inflammation of this part of your body called the epididymis.
That helps it out.
Exactly. Which is a little tube that connects the testicle with another part called the vas deferens. And so that little tube can get inflamed or infected and can be painful.
And this is, for most men, the testicle is a nice, smooth surface. But up above and up and right below it, we sometimes call, there's things that feel like worm-like structures, and those are where the epididymis lies. And when they get inflamed, not only are they tender, they're painful. And so a testicle can get swollen and painful, so painful they come to the doctor thinking that I may need to get treatment, and almost always they do.
And it's more common in young men ages 19 to 35, but it could happen to older men as well. It can be related to a sexually transmitted infection, and in most instances, some type of antibiotic is prescribed to help you get better.
And unfortunately, for older men who maybe have chronic prostatitis, inflammation of that prostate gland, or this epididymitis, they can be a kind of a chronic infection, and so people may need to be on antibiotics a little longer or recurrent basis. The good news is it is treatable. In addition to which, really good support so that to the testicle so that it gets supported while it's inflamed can be helpful and for comfort measures.
Hopefully that's helpful to you, and hopefully this has already gotten better for you
and
it's no longer scary. Yeah, exactly. We're thinking the same.
Maybe painful, but not as scary.
Let's hear our next House Call question.
I occasionally experience vertigo when I get out of bed in the morning. It goes away and I can go about my day. What could be causing it?
Yeah, that's another big word that we sometimes, I think doctors like throw that word around a lot, vertigo. And it maybe doesn't do justice to how bad people really feel when they have this really bad dizziness.
Have you ever had vertigo? I've had it once or twice, and it is really scary because the room is just spinning wildly and you can't control it.
The closest, Christy, I had is when I was on a ship, and that feeling when you're on a ship and that mm-hmm. ship has like 4 to 6 foot foot swells, which is really
bad feeling.
And you start to feel really nauseous, that's one of the potential symptoms of vertigo.
So usually people, when you complain of dizziness, doctors are trying to help you describe, is it lightheadedness, which is, or is it vertigo? Vertigo is more of that sensation of the room spinning. It can be caused by a lot of different things. And I think it's reassuring that it only happens to you perhaps in certain positions in the morning, and that you're able to go about your day without any other problems. That, to me, points more towards one of the what we call benign reasons to get vertigo.
And, you know, vertigo can be from so many things. Just like you said, Christy, people should really look at the medications they're taking, mm-hmm. and prescription, as well as over-the-counter, even herbal medicines, because lots of things can cause that. Really probably work with your primary care provider to see what can be done, because there are some medicines that can also be used to treat it periodically. Mm-hmm. And be helpful and really help out decrease that spinning movement, sometimes in the inner ear, where, you know, we make it sound like this is something benign, and it is, in terms of it's maybe not cancerous, but it's not benign for the way you feel.
Definitely not. And it could be something as little as a virus that causes inflammation in that inner ear, or something called benign paroxysmal positional vertigo that just comes in certain positions. But it also could be related to something more serious if you had hearing loss or other symptoms. So do go get it checked out, and we hope that it just goes away.
You know where that word vertigo comes from, Christy?
Where
this is
going to
be really
from?
Helpful. It comes from the Latin word verto.
Oh, well, thank you. That sheds so much light.
Which means spinning. Now that we know that, let's listen to our very next house call.
My mother recently experienced her first shingles outbreak. I have always heard that older individuals are susceptible to it and that it can be caused by weakened immune systems. If a younger person with a weaker immune system has come into contact with a person experiencing shingle outbreaks, should they look into getting the shingles vaccine? And is there a minimum age to get that vaccine?
Thank you for that question. That is a good question, and one that is actually a little bit complex.
It is, and I think if you've been close to someone who has suffered from shingles, from the kind of pain that it causes, or had that post-herpetic neuralgia, which is the fancy name for the pain that can linger after shingles, if you've been around that, then you're smart to want to try to avoid it.
And the age in which it's recommended has come down. So now for the general population over the age of 50, now that doesn't mean that it's approved by all insurances, but you can, if you are over 50 and you're healthy, get a shingles vaccination to kind of cut down on your chances of getting it. However, if you have a weakened immune system, truly weakened immune system, not just you get a cold every now and then, but if you are on chronic prednisone or have some other really chronic problem, you really actually don't, you can't get the shingles vaccination because it could actually reactivate a problem in you.
So if you are age 60 or older, definitely consider the shingles vaccine. And if you're younger in that 50 to 59 age range, it's possible that you could get it. I think if you're really young, much younger than that, it's not recommended at this time to get a shingles vaccine. But you want to think about, did you get protection from chickenpox, which is the same virus that happens when you're young? So if you hadn't had chickenpox, have you looked into the varicella vaccine, which is related?
And finally, if you have a really weak immune system, you're on chronic prednisone, for instance, stay away from someone who actually has the shingles. That's the best way of you avoiding trying to get it at that particular time. Thank you so much for that great question.
Let's take our last house call.
I went to the doctor earlier this week regarding a fever, headache, and lack of appetite I had for a few days. The doctor, who wasn't my usual doctor, seemed unconcerned and prescribed regular ibuprofen, which I declined to take. Since then, my fever and headache went away, but my body has been acting very strangely. My whole skin turns red, I have a metallic taste in my mouth, and my appetite remains low. My extremities are slightly tingly, and my body feels sore. When I hold a limb in one place for a long time, it feels all sore and strange. I'm very thirsty, and my mouth gets dry quickly, but I'm drinking a ton of water. I'm totally functional. I've been at work these 2 days, so nothing seems too crazy. It's all just very weird. What could be going on?
Wow, that sounds like you went through quite a bit. But I'm glad to hear that it sounds like you were able to work the whole time. But it sounds like you had a lot of different kinds of symptoms that may have been related to that initial, perhaps, virus that you had.
This is that time of year in which doctors are going to blame everything on viruses. And it's true.
It is.
But the question is, what type of virus? And I'm not so certain we're so good at really figuring out, because there are several types of virus. There's something called adenovirus, A-D-E-N-O virus, that can cause lots of symptoms. Maybe not all of these, but it can cause some of these.
Mm-hmm. There are multiple viruses, including the flu itself, that can cause your body to ache and feel joint pains and muscle pains as a part of that. You know, I look at all this and would say, well, one, if your skin was red all over and you're having all these things, definitely go get checked out again. But also the fact that you're able to work and sounds like you're feeling otherwise okay, I'd say try that Motrin. The doctor told you to and you didn't want to, so I'd want to know more about why you didn't take it. But that can be helpful to sort of decrease the pain and some of these other symptoms that can come with viruses.
Or acetaminophen or Tylenol, mm-hmm. if you don't want to take ibuprofen. And maybe there might even be some herbal treatments here that wouldn't harm you. You know, we've touted honey for some coughs, and some people will take some herbal teas with honey here. Don't know if it'll help. Might make you feel a little better.
It might. We hope you are feeling better. It sounds like you're making progress and that all the symptoms just totally go away very, very soon.
Well, that'll conclude our house calls for today, and we want to thank you for joining us on Your Health. We hope we've addressed issues that are important to you. You can send us your questions at yourhealth@unc.edu.
We want to thank the staff of WCHL, UNC Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Dr. Susan Glaude. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And I'm Dr. Christy Page. And we'll talk with you again next week. Take care.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, presented by UNC Family Medicine. You can find this or any other episode of Your Health at WCHL's website, chapelboro.com. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on 97.9 FM, WCHL, Chapel Hill Carborough's news, talk, and Tar Heel station.